This audio is produced and distributed by the Christian Biblical Church of God, Post Office Box 1442, Hollister, California, 95024-1442. To visit our websites, they are cbcg.org and biblicaltruthministries.org. Yeah, what we need to do is realize that God sees the whole picture. And for us to see the whole picture as God sees it, we need to draw close to God and learn from the lessons we go through. Okay. And the lessons that you go through and the trials you experience are not the ones that you have thought of in your mind, that you kind of have a pre-planned battle document ready to fight it, if I could put it that way. See? Because you can say in your mind, well, if this trial comes, well, I'm prepared for this trial. That's not the one you're going to get. Okay? Now, when we left Worldwide, we started Biblical. And that lasted 3 years. And the Constitution and bylaws that we developed with that one was almost, when I saw United, I looked at United and it was deja vu. Committee here, committee there, committee everywhere. And what I had to learn. And this is how I learned that God doesn't want a hierarchy. What I had to learn was that committees with carnal men only create multiple political power bases. See? And so, that got so bad and hateful that we had to leave. And our exit from Worldwide was very pleasant compared to the exit from Biblical, which was hateful and mean and nasty. And to have someone you consider a close friend turn on you, you know, like that Psalm 28 in the hymnal, was not a foe that did deride, but a friend and my guide. When his words were smoother than butter. See, and his knife slipped in under the fifth rib. See. And it was a very disillusioning time. 49, four kids, no income, no vacation, no severance, no nothing. And I won't fill you in all the details, but we started out a couple weeks later, and I didn't know what to do or where to go. And Esther Greisinger called me. You probably heard me mention this on a tape before. And she said, you know, she called, and I didn't want to talk to her. And I don't want to talk to anybody. Bam. And when I'm mean and nasty, I'm mean and nasty. And I was mean and nasty, but she was patient and persistent. So she called back and said, don't hang up, don't hang up, please don't hang up. So I said, okay. So she said, there will be seven of us up here. We'd like to have you come up on Sabbath and bring us a Bible study. And so that's how Christian Biblical got started. Biblical Church of God did not have very much Christianity in it. See? And the first lesson I learned was you don't run down the road and say, this is the work of God, this is the work of God, and since it's the work of God, by the way, God, you better bless it, because I say it's the work of God. It took me a long time to really understand what God was doing. Though I knew he was doing something. What it was, I didn't know. And I got so low, that I remember just kind of driving around out north of Hollister, out in the country, and here's this little hill. And so I just got out of the car and just climbed up to the top of the hill and just got on my knees and just asked God, heal my soul. You know, because you're so wounded to everything that takes place, you just don't feel as though you have any soul or heart left, you see. And that's all I could say. You know, tears streaming down and so forth. God heard and answered that prayer. And it was sometime later I began to understand about a hierarchy. But it wasn't until God put us through that trial. It was difficult on me, on my wife, on my children. And they suffer as well. But you see, through that then, I have learned that you don't need a hierarchy. What you need is love and cooperation and structure to what you need for the physical needs, and do what you need to do. See? And then you can have peace and cooperation because you're all loving each other and loving God. That way you're not striving as to who's in charge. If someone comes up with a good idea of doing things, why do it? You know? If someone has a question or something where they understand some truth in the Bible and bring it out, if it's truth, correct, is it not? Yes. As I said through the years, fully 50% of my sermons have come from questions that the brethren have had. And we stayed at that 7 for a long time. And that's when I first began to sit down and teach. Because wouldn't it be stupid to stand up in a pulpit and browbeat 7 people? Now listen here, brethren, you know. And that's, and we discuss things quite often. And that's when we decided, well, regardless of what happens, we're just going to keep our noses in the Bible and study the Word of God and let God do the calling and let God do the adding. So we had 7 in the congregation and 3 on the mailing list, and that was it. See? And I learned to do real estate loans. So I had a job that I hated, being a loan broker, which I had to do, and I made pretty good money at it, and became quite proficient in it, by the way. I ended up learning so much that I always had to tell the title company how to run their business, and that got me irritated as can be, but nevertheless. And then my other job was being a minister, which the world hates. So when someone asked me, well, what do you do? I says, well, I have 2 occupations that are despised. I'm a loan broker, one's a minister, you know. Hello, are we at cross purposes? But at 49 and with 4 kids, that's the only thing I could learn where I could make decent enough money. I started out as a loan officer, and from November until August, I earned $1,400. Then I got my California CFL broker license, which is consumer finance lender license. And from August to December, I made $14,000. And there were times when I grossed, $110,000, something like that. So, but it was all commission. I didn't get a thing till I close alone. So it really, really became quite challenging. And I'd have to get out and drive around, leave my rate sheets and, you know, talk to real estate people. They didn't always tell a new loan person walking in. Got his rate sheet in hand. Hello! It's almost like a big sign. New loan broker in town. And all the real estate agents, and they are snitty people indeed, they throw you the worst crumbs to try and get a loan with defunct credit and defunct property. So actually, I specialized in that. And I made some pretty good money at it. And then I got in contact with a private investor in town. Just by happenstance. Browder was his name. I didn't know him, but he's a big mucky muck in town. But he keeps a pretty low profile because he builds and sells houses. And he had some money that he wanted to loan out and earn more than he could by just making a loan to someone without security or having to take a second. So then I began to specialize in construction loans, which are short-term loans. And so he would fund the money. We would put it into a trust account. They would earn interest on the trust account, and then we would draw down according to the construction schedule upon phased completion. So he would earn a point, and I would earn a point, and I would get some fees, plus the inspection fees, and then I would earn a point on the rollover to the final loan. So this worked real well. He made lots of money. I made lots of money. I suppose we funded pretty close to $10 million worth of loans on a rollover basis, you know. We fund one, close it out with a permanent loan, fund another one. And so that worked quite well. But my heart was really never in it, though I could do it well. And I had to learn. That's where God then began teaching me a lot of things, because I was not around anybody except our little congregation. And when I was driving, and I would drive, I would put on 60,000 miles a year just driving, you know, taking care of business and going to church and all that sort of thing. And my mind would always be on the scriptures. And I remember one day driving down the road where I just felt real muddled. You ever felt real muddled? Yeah, you're all smiling. You've all felt real muddled. And I remember just crying out to God, saying, "Oh, God, I'm so stupid. I really got zonked in on this thing with biblical. And I let people take me down the garden path. And I don't know how to think. Please help me to think. Help me to understand. And God has helped me a great deal." But you see, all the things that we went through in that has been not only a benefit to us, but a benefit to the people of God. See? And of course, in that condition, how many people would follow us? Not very many. So we got our noses in the Bible. And so instead of every year getting up and repeating the same thing, you know, like in Worldwide, I have my stack of sermon notes that I go through every 4 years. Okay. We decided just to get our noses in the Bible and go through verse by verse and word by word. Not have any set schedule. We'll just stick with it till we're done. First thing we did was a series in Romans, which we lost the originals for it. But nevertheless, we did a better series in Romans after we got the translation done. Then we did the whole Gospel of John verse by verse. And it took us 2.5 years to do that. We had 26 tapes in the major part of it, and then 26 tapes in the sub-series. And that's where we have the series on grace, sanctification, holiness, and so forth. We don't send out the series on John because it is, with the whole thing, it's quite lengthy. And it was during the series of John. Here, let's go to the book of John. During the series in John, okay, let's just use an example here, if I can find one. Okay, let's come to John 5, verse 24. Well, at that time, I was studying the Greek. And what I would do, every night when I would get home, I would study the Greek. Study, study, study. Dr. Dorothy said, study, study, study. Memorize, 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 memorize. Study, 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 study. Memorize, 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 memorize. And Greek is very difficult. And if I hadn't had German before, it would have been much harder for me to learn. But I had the equivalent of 2 years of Dr. Dorothy tutoring. And then I was on my own. So I would come home and I would study the Greek, study the Greek, study the Greek. And when we would go through the book of John, okay, let's pick it up here in verse 24, John 5. Let me explain to you. Verily, verily, and all through the book of John, I would remind everyone that means truly, truly. I say unto you, he that heareth my words and believeth on me. You see, the ETH is a present tense participle in the Greek. See? And I would always say that. This means the one who is hearing my word and who is believing on him that sent me has everlasting life. And so by the time we got done with the series on John, I was very tired of telling people the Greek says this, the Greek says that, and so were the brethren. And you know, that's how ministers hold the intellectual edge over people. By making it sound very complicated. See, well, I know the Greek, and all of you are a bunch of stupid lay people. So we decided, I said, how would you like to do a study going through the seven general epistles? Okay? And instead of going through telling you what the Greek says, I'll translate it. So that was my first attempt at translating James, 1st, 2nd Peter, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, and Jude. Now we've got the seven general epistles book, and we have 79 tapes to go with it. One series at a time, please. See. So as we got done with that, the different ones said, well, I said, how would you like to study Romans when we get done with this? Fine. So then I began translating in earnest in the book of Romans. And so that's how the translation started out. It started out just to make it simple and easy for the brethren to understand. That's all. I haven't set myself up to say, Fred, are you not important? Thou art a Greekist scholar. See, which some people have accused me of. And some people accuse me that I am the only one that knows anything that's in the Bible. No, God is the only one that knows everything that's in the Bible. What we know. There's a whole lot more for us to learn. But I'll tell you one thing. I'm not going to stand still for false doctrine. Now, if it's real damaging, like what John Reitenbaugh did with Pentecost, I name the person. And some sensitive politicians say, oh, you shouldn't name the person. Well, I did the tape. I sent the booklet and the tape. with a letter to John Reitenbach. And I said, John, I love you, I care for you, but in this you're just completely wrong. And that I'm sending this to you in time so you can recover before Pentecost comes. And I sent it also to John Reed, one of his close associates. So anyway, that's how I got started translating the New Testament. Then I thought, well, I will do the rest of the epistles of Paul. And then we were running low on the harmony of the gospel, so I said, well, we need a precise translation for the next edition of the harmony rather than a paraphrase. So lo and behold, we're pretty close to doing the whole New Testament. So I said, okay, why not do the whole New Testament? Not that I think that I'm a greater scholar above anybody else and can know more than they do, but all of these New Age Bible versions are just leading people astray. So that's how it came about. So we have the harmony almost done, and we'll be full-time on finishing the New Testament. In the meantime, through it, God has blessed us all with a lot of understanding. See? And there's still so much there for us to learn. See? So anyway, that's the long and short of where we are today. So now that you heard me rattle on, let's take some of your questions. The comment is, what are some of the things that I got myself in trouble with Pasadena? Okay? And why I was marked as such a miserable, mean person. Okay? It goes back quite a long ways. And it wasn't that I was rebellious. It was that I thought that the truth was over everybody. Well, is it or is it not? Is that a right thought or a wrong thought? It's a right thought. Okay. So when I came to Ambassador College, I knew that I was going to be a minister in my own heart, though they said, don't you dare think that you're going to be a minister. I said, okay, well, if God doesn't want me to be, I won't be. But nevertheless, if God does, then I will be. And so I approached everything at Ambassador College when I went. I went 61. I graduated in 64. I went 3 years because I had 3.5 years college before. And I applied myself to the Scriptures and studied the Scriptures. And I did something which I very rarely even mentioned because lest someone think I'm bragging or whatever, but I'm not. I'm just going to state a fact. Herbert Armstrong said he studied the Bible on his knees, so I thought that if I'm going to learn the Bible, I better study the Bible on my knees. And where we were, they had these prayer booths. And when we were going to college, the prayer booths were used all the time. All the students were praying. When I went back there in 72, they were all stuffed as storage bins. But nevertheless, I found a prayer booth down here. How many have been to Del Mar? Downstairs, you come downstairs, and to the left, there's some prayer booths, and to the right, there's the furnace, and straight ahead is the fellowship room. You all go down there and fellowship in the refrigerator, and you have your cheese and pickles and stuff in there, you know. So to the right, there was the furnace and three prayer booths. Well, the third prayer booth over here, just up over on the wall, was an outlet. So I got an extension cord, and I took my little tabletop desk lamp, which is the crook neck with single bulb, and I plugged it in, and I took it into the prayer booth with me, and I studied. That's where I studied. And I did what they said at the time was, that your personal Bible study has nothing to do with your classes. That's separate. See? And I was never political. Never political. Still not to this day. Never will be. Thank you, God. Anyway. So, I did well in class. No one, in my second year there, they didn't quite know what to do with me, job-wise. Because I had studied German and I was quite proficient in German at that time, so they thought maybe they could put me in the German work. But then Frank Schnee was there and whoever else was there, so that took care of that. So they didn't know what to do with me. And for work, they put me up in letter reading. So up in letter reading, and I would always, someone write in for the first time, I make sure they get why were you born, and some other basic booklets to help them. And be studying. Meanwhile, we took all the classes. We took, you know, the speech class, the Bible class, you know, Dr. Hayes' history class. And the only way you learn in Dr. Hayes' history class is sit up in the front row and look them right in the eyes so you can be alert and stay awake. Because if you sit in the back, all the dum-dums sit in the back and he knows it, and they get straight D's. So anyway, yeah, Carl and I always used to sit up in the front and in Dr. Hayes' world history class, I made this big long chart, you know, going through compendium 1, compendium 2, and all of that. And the students at that time were dedicated, and they were praying, and they were studying. There was a whole different spirit there until Mrs. Armstrong died in 1967. Okay? Well, anyway, it came senior year, and lo and behold, when they called out the assignments for ministerial sentence, my name came up. And everyone was shocked when my name came up, Fred Coulter to Eugene to assist Dale Hampton. See, because it wasn't political. No one knew too much about me except the different teachers and so forth. So I went out there and I assisted Dale Hampton the best I could. And he had a very unfortunate situation. He had a son that was a complete paraplegic. Nothing but just a bag of bones. Ricky was his name. Couldn't get out of, you know, had to be diapered, had to be fed. Very sad, very tragic. And the assistants would mow the lawn and do all the errands and things like this. So I did all of that. And I was very happy to do it. But I remember one real moment I had was when I was helping Dale Hampton. We were getting ready for the feast. And they couldn't take Ricky to the feast, so they always left him with a woman who would watch over him. And I remember that I had to pick him up and carry him out to the car. And that was really quite an experience. You know. And so Dale Hampton really had a burden with that. And unfortunately, he became just a complete alcoholic over. Very sad. But anyway, I hope this begins to answer the question. But when they decided, I'll tell you another little side story here. When they decided that I could go out and visit on my own, they sent me sent me out with Otis Cole, one of the sweetest men in the world. And we would talk. He's a very, what you might say, shy and unassuming man. And we became very close friends. And he did almost all the talking once he got warmed up. So he told me about the old days at the school in Jefferson School, where Mr. Armstrong started. And he told me something else that really flabbergasted me. He said that he was in the Church of God Seventh Day, born into it. His father was an elder in the Church of God Seventh Day. And that in 1917, his father Now listen to this. Brought to Duggar and Dodd the truth of Israel and the holy days. 10 years before Herbert Armstrong ever found out about the Church of God. And I also found out that Mrs. Runcorn was a member of the Church of God Seventh Day. See, so there's a little fudging in the autobiography as you go along. See. But nevertheless. So when Herbert Armstrong in 1931 brought up about Israel and holy days, guess what? Duggar and Dodd had already been through it. See? And I remember when I was up in Boise. Well, we'll have to back up here. Okay. Then, in 1965, January, Dolores and I got married. Came back up and lived in Eugene. And then in April, for the Feast of Unleavened Bread, at that time we still had the whole region of the district thing where everyone would come into Portland. And Herbert Armstrong came in, stayed the whole week. He and his wife, Loma, we had services every day. And they scheduled me to bring a sermonette. And so I brought a sermonette on 1 Chronicles 28. Serve God with a willing heart and keep His commandments. That's what David told Solomon. And my wife, who was a close friend of Loma, was sitting right there with Loma, and Herbert was right there, and she goes like this, Dolores told me, like that to Herbert, and says, "You better ordain that man." See, well, I guess they already had plans to ordain me, because the last day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread in 1965, which then is, today is that anniversary of that, never thought of it until just now, I was ordained by Herbert W. Armstrong, personally, see. And I never really had any problems with Herbert W. Armstrong. Well, what they did, they sent me on over to Boise to pastor in Boise. And so Dolores and I, when we got married, we packed up everything in our Fury 3 Plymouth four-door. We had the trunk full and the back seat full. Well, when we packed up to go to Boise, we filled up the back seat, the trunk, and a U-Haul trailer. So we went on over to Boise. And we relieved Fred Kellers over there, and Fred Kellers have never liked me to this day, because I took over where he thought he should have stayed. And I was ordained before him because he graduated the year before me. So here's all this political stuff going on, see, and I'm not even aware of it. So we get over to Boise and everything is going along fine. And lo and behold, one day, here's a man that shows up in services, never saw before. So I go over and introduce myself, and he introduces himself as Ray Benight, minister of Church of God Seventh Day. Interesting. This is the one that Herbert Armstrong knew personally. Okay. So he said, "Well, why don't you come by and visit me?" He says, "I live in Napa." I said, "Be happy to." So I came by to visit him one day, around some visiting, and we're sitting there talking, and then he starts against Herbert Armstrong. Tells me how vain he was and how everything he was and so forth. And so when he got done, I just said, "Well," I said, "Mr. Benight," I said, "isn't it a shame that God had to use Herbert Armstrong to preach the truth about Israel in the holy days because no one in the Church of God Seventh Day would?" Of course, I got up and left. Okay. Well, when we went down to visit in Pasadena, Dolores told Loma about it. So Loma called Herbert, and here I'm around the campus taking pictures because they just got the auditorium done. They were redoing some things, and I wanted to take them back and show the slides to the brethren. So here one of the guards come up to me and says, You're wanted up in Herbert Armstrong's office right now. What have I done? See? That's when his office was up over the old library. So I get in the elevator, go up, see him, and he welcomes me with open arms, and he wanted me to tell him everything about Ray Benite and the other Church of God Seventh-day ministers that I had run across. We sat there and talked for over 2 hours. And it was a wonderful conversation. Very delightful. See? I never had anything against Herbert Armstrong. It was later what Stan Rader coerced him into doing. So lo and behold, I get down there, and boy, David John Hill lights into me a couple hours later and says, "What are you doing up in Herbert Armstrong's office? Are you trying to gain something?" See, and that's how the hierarchy always viewed me, see. I said, "Hey, I was invited up. What am I going to do?" See. Okay. Our first child was a girl, born 2 months premature, and died at 9 months in our own arms. So we know what it's like to lose a child. So they decided that it would be best for us to move out of the Boise area and go down to Salt Lake and hook Salt Lake up with Boise, and I would fly every week. Well, being in that remote geographical area, I had to run everything on my own. Carlton Smith was the district superintendent, and he would come over when I first went to Boise once a month, and then once every other month, and then every 6 months, and then once a year, and he'd say, "Hi, Fred, how's everything? Fine, bye, Fred, see you next time." See? So, even though I was within the Worldwide Church of God, I was not highly connected to the hierarchy in as much as that I was virtually operating on my own. But I was not in rebellion to the authority that was in the church, nor did I put down Pasadena. I always upheld Pasadena. Okay, but I was not the fanatic that I would mention Herbert Armstrong's name as I scored in one sermon 110 times by Dave Albert in Pasadena years later. 110 times in one sermon. So, anyway, we moved down to Salt Lake, and I decided to do a series in Galatians, and I still have the paper, by the way. And we were told that if you write up anything, or if you find any new truth, quote unquote, write it up and send it in. So I began to, here, let's go to Galatians 3. Galatians 3, because there's a glaring contradiction here if you read it. And in talking to the Church of God Seventh-day ministers, I began to understand that Herbert Armstrong was preaching Galatians 3 according to the Church of God Seventh-day understanding, which is basically this. Let's come to verse 19. Galatians 3. "Wherefore then serves the law?" Meaning the law of sacrifices. This is the way it is was understood. "It was added because of transgressions, because when Moses was on the mountain, the children of Israel sinned. Till the seed should come to whom the promise was made," and so forth. Well, that's not the correct meaning, because you have a contradiction here. Let's go back to verse 14. "That the blessing of Abraham might come on the Gentiles through Jesus Christ, that we might receive the promise of the Spirit through faith. And brethren, I speak after the manner of men. Though it be but a man's covenant, yet if it be confirmed, no man disannuls or adds to." Well, how can you have verse 19, "It was added," when it says you can't add to? See, there's a distinct contradiction within three verses. So I read on. "Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. He said, not into seeds of many, but as of one, and to your seed, which is Christ. And this I say, that the covenant which was confirmed before of God in Christ, the law which was given to Israel, meaning the whole old covenant, which was 430 years afterward, cannot disannul that it should make the promise of no effect. So we're talking about the promise. We're not talking about law upon law. We are talking about promise and covenant. For if inheritance be of the law, that is, through the old covenant, it is no more a promise, but God gave it to Abraham by promise. Wherefore then serves the law, meaning the whole old covenant, not just the law of sacrifices. It was placed alongside the promises, because you can't add to it, but you can place it alongside, for the purpose of showing what transgression is, till the seed should come to whom the promise was made. And so I wrote that up and I sent it in to Pasadena, and guess whose hands it goes through? And I did a very bad thing. I rented a bulletin typewriter. It has type this big, so that Herbert Armstrong could read it, because remember, his eyes, he had the blood clot behind his eye. Went to the hands of Roderick Meredith and Al Carosa. And I didn't know it, but their thought was, see, not interested in truth. Now, if I would have brought it to Herbert Armstrong personally, I am sure he would have embraced it. I am sure he would have taught it. See? But they looked at it. Who is this upstart to correct Herbert Armstrong, God's apostle? That's right. And I didn't know this. So here I am marked and targeted. So, sometime later, let me just mention that we had a woman that was dying of breast cancer, and my woman saw her breast, and it was black as coal, and she was on her deathbed. And so we had the church in Boise and Salt Lake fast, and I came back from Boise on Sunday. And I remember we took Morgan Tubby, who was a deacon with me, and I went up to anoint her. I remember walking in the house, and you could smell death. Walked in, and here she is in pain and misery and agony and just, you know, skin and bones. And at that point, you know, I knew either God had to heal her or she had to die. And so that was my prayer. I just kneeled down and anointed her and said, God, you know, if it is your will to heal her, please do. If not, let her die quickly and end the suffering. Got up, she started to improve right away, and she also, with the help of the women, did a lot of things with herbs to purge the cancer out of her system, and in 10 days she was up walking about and healed. And she was completely healed and restored to health. So, Rod Meredith down in Pasadena schedules a visit to come out and see this rebellious Fred, who would dare write something against Herbert Armstrong. Well, I didn't write it against him. I'm just following their instructions that if there's something new, you write it up and send it in. Okay. So he calls up. This is just a regular field visit, Fred. Oh, that's fine. Yes, yes, yes. Of course, I didn't know what he had in mind, see, till just before the end of his visit. So I said, well, how would you like us to have Spokesman's Club and a dinner dance in Salt Lake and then Bible study and then Sabbath services and then go on up to Boise and then you can preach there and then we'll have Spokesman's Club afterwards with a dinner dance and so forth. He said, yeah, that'll be fine. So we got it all set up. He came out and we had the dinner dance, and he got done with his evaluation. After hearing all the men speak, you know, table topics and all the speeches and everything. And he got up and he said, and I know this galled him, but he said, at least he was honest in it, this is the best spokesman club I have ever seen, regardless of where I've gone in the whole United States. Said the questions were the most intelligent with the best answers I've ever heard. See. And then we get out there and we're dancing, and he comes up to me and says, well, where's this Mrs. Beam who was healed of cancer? So I showed him where she was, dancing with her husband. So he goes over there. You know how Rod does. He cocks his head like this, and he's over there talking with her. And I guess he really didn't believe that she had cancer and that she was completely healed. See? So how can Fred be so bad if all of this is coming out this way, see? You know. So he was stymied because he was expecting to find a rebellious congregation, you know, and all this sort of thing. Went up to Boise and the same thing. He was flabbergasted. So Sunday morning, after we come back to Salt Lake City, he has his overall evaluation for me and Dolores. And that's when I understood the purpose of his visit. We sit down and, you know, he has his stern look and he says, do you believe that Herbert Armstrong is God's apostle? Well, I suppose with the paper he didn't think that I did. Because how dare you correct him, see? Well, I didn't think I was correcting him. I thought I was bringing, you know, new truth. He didn't say that, but this was kind of the thought in mind. I said, well, of course I do. He says, well, this paper you wrote, the only thing he could find wrong with it was, he said, and you should have never rented that bulletin typewriter and used church funds to do it, $125. That's the only thing he could get me on, see? Okay, later. Later. Intrigue within the hierarchy. So anyway, a couple years later, let me just finish this. So Rod Meredith had to go back to Pasadena. He had no goods on me for anything. Okay. Then one summer, they sent out as a ministerial assistant, Carl Keller. Anybody know Carl Keller? He was out west and down south. Anyway, he was a gung-ho Marine jet pilot who was vain, arrogant, considered himself God's gift to humanity, especially the church, because there was no one like him. So they sent him out to be a ministerial assistant for me. Well, needless to say, he was very arrogant and presuming upon the brethren on everything. And so when I wrote up an evaluation, of course, that's a summary of many details. I could tell you half a dozen incidences with that. I put down there that Carl Kellner has a lot of ability, but until he gets rid of his vanity and arrogance and presuming upon the brethren, that he should never be ordained as a minister. Well, Pasadena had slotted him to be ordained to be a minister. Of course, I didn't know that. So. Okay. So, the next spring, when he graduates, Richard Plache says, Carl, come here, I want you to read something. So he hands him that evaluation. So there's my enemy number one. Okay? Of course, I didn't know this until years later. So then I get a call from David John Hill, and he says there's a man who has been disfellowshipped in the church in Phoenix, and he's moved up to Boise, and he's threatening to sue the church for $50,000. I want you to straighten this out. I'm going to send you all the information. Now be careful. This man is a notorious liar. Okay. So I got the file. I just put it on my desk, did nothing with it. And so the man whose name was Brent Nolan called John Hill, because I hadn't contacted him, and said, well, I haven't heard from the minister yet. So he gave my number. So he called me. So he says, I'm Brent Nolan, and I understand you're to help solve the problem on my disfellowshipment case. I said, yeah, I was hoping to avoid it. You know, I was hoping just not have to go through it. So I said, well, he said, let's get together. And I said, well, the only time I can get together is after the Day of Atonement. And at that time, we had Rand Millich up there as a local elder who was assisting me in Boise. I said, well, we'll meet at his house. So I had all of this in mind, that he was disfellowshipped, accused of adultery, he defrauded a widow, notorious liar. Watch out for everything that he has to say, because nothing can possibly be true. Okay, so we get over there to Rand Millich's place, and we sit down, and he's telling me these horror stories. What happened? That the minister went around to his business contacts, ruined his business, went to the phone company, destroyed his credit. And I'm sitting there, this is unreal. How am I going to know this guy's telling the truth? So I just sit there and listen. And he said, and I've had bleeding bowels over it. Ding, the light went on. If a man is a notorious, hard-hearted liar, he surely would not have bleeding bowels, would he? Okay? So I was praying. I said, oh, God, help me to understand. Help me, you know. So the idea came to me, this is Day of Atonement. So I looked him right in the eye and I said, today's Day of Atonement. Are you fasting? He says, of course. I said, well, do you keep the Sabbath? He says, yes, every week at home. I said to myself, based on that, I'm going to look at this thing through. So I says, you have my word. Soon as feast over, I'll come back and look into it. Well, the long and short of it was, he did not commit adultery with a woman, but it was on the word of one person who saw him go into a house of a woman alone to give an estimate for a remodel job. Okay? And that he put an addition on a widow's home in Phoenix made of adobe brick according to the plan she approved. And he gave all of his labor and a good portion of the material free. And he put it on according to the plans, and she came out there, now mind you, with adobe brick. She says, I want the windows moved from this wall over to this wall. And he said, I can't do that. He said, do you realize that I have to tear it down to the level of the sill? And rebuild the whole thing and destroy half of the adobe brick to do it for you? And I've already done it where I can't afford to do it. So he walked off and left it. So therefore, Ron Reedy, the destroyer of brethren, he destroyed him. Said, well, he's defrauded a widow. He's committed adultery with a woman. It was sent into Pasadena. Guess who was the district superintendent? Al Carozzo. He took it up to Rod Meredith. Guess who upheld it? Rod Meredith. Came down when Vernon Hargrove was sent over there for the second tour and went on up. Came down with the second result. They upheld it three times. So here I got this package now. So here I'm going through it. So I talked to Ron Reedy and I talked to Vernon Hargrove and I talked to different people, and I said, well, now how am I going to get my way through this thing? So I decided, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to call a local contractor. Had the dimensions of the addition he was going to do and, you know, the materials and so forth. So I said, now, I said, I want you to give me the lowest possible price of an adobe addition this big and tell me what it would cost a square foot to do. He said, $17 a square foot. Okay, I said, do you think that a man who did it for $5 a square foot was defrauding a woman? And I explained about removing the windows and everything. He said, no. I said, would you redo the windows? He said, no. Especially if she refused to pay for it. He would not do it. Would you walk off and leave it? Absolutely. So I said, okay, he didn't sin against her. He didn't defraud her. She sinned against him by changing the plans. See? So I took that, put it over here. Then I decided, well, here are all of these nice letters from deacons and local elders, you know, the obedient sycophant spies. Well, we had we had Brent Noller and his wife over for dinner, and it was rather cold and stiff. Well, Brent was no idiot. He knew what was going on. See? So I had to say, okay, everything that's a sin against God, I'm going to put over here. Everything that's not a sin against God, I'm going to put over here. And I read through all of that, and it was really eye-opening. All the stuff, all the false accusations, all the way that they railroaded this guy, you know, to use the hierarchy to uphold a disfellowship, but I ended up with nothing over here against God and everything over here that was foolishness and not a sin. So I got done with that, and I called John Hill, and I said, I've solved the problem. Said he hasn't sinned against God. He says, well, good, call Brett, reinstate him, have him come to church. Okay. So I write up the report and send it in, and guess whose hands it goes to? Al Carozzo and Rod Meredith. How dare he go against the authority, see? Well, I didn't know that. Al Carozzo came out for a visit for Pentecost, and he really kept his cool. I mean, he was slick. He said, Fred, we have a nice big promotion for you. You've been out here for 7 years now? We have two big churches down in the headquarters area we'd like you to pastor, Torrance and Santa Monica. Okay. Well, what could I say? You know. And I was literally a lamb led to the slaughter, believe me. So we get on down there. Guess who the replacement minister is by design? Carl Kellner. With orders to find out everything about Fred Coulter, every dirty little thing he could dig up. And he couldn't. So he wrote up reports that I run everything by politics and I'm not a politician. And my wife was a dirty housekeeper because there were rings in the toilet with Salt Lake City water hardness of 0.55. It was all contrived. But meanwhile, I get on down to Pasadena, and lo and behold, I have an eye-opening experience. I find that Al Portun is in this corner of the fourth floor. Rod Meredith is in this corner of the fourth floor. Garner Ted Armstrong is in this corner of the fourth floor. And Herbert Armstrong is this corner of the fourth floor. And Stan Rader is here. And all the different lieutenants with their various allegiance are all in between. And I found out that Rod hated Ted and Ted hated Rod and they were contrary one to another, couldn't stand each other, that Al Portun had his own agenda, Rader had his own agenda, and poor Herbert Armstrong was all stuck off over here in the side. And here at God's headquarters, where you'd think love and truth would reign, we had carnality and hatred and politics and intrigue. Well, I got my dose of it. Al Carozzo, he had a meeting every week. All the sycophants come up and sit around. I remember one man, Ben Chapman, very well. He would sit at the right hand of Al Carozzo, and he was just like the yes man of the mafia. And he would always ask those leading questions for brownie points. You know, I call them brownie point questions. So here, I'm always sitting down here clear at the other end because I don't want any part of it, see. Which makes them believe that I'm as bad as they really think I am because I'm not participating in this stuff because I think it's stupidness and you don't need it. What do you need a meeting every week for except to come around and polish the shoes of Al Carozzo? See? And I wouldn't do that. Nor the other infamous things that, you know, you can say in slang about it. So little did I realize that they were working this case up against me in Salt Lake City. And when I came down to Torrance and Santa Monica, we'd have a combined Bible study at the Los Angeles Civic Center, and I was giving the series The Last 10 Days of Christ's Life. And Dave Brady, who was a printer, came up to me and said, you gotta write a book. I said, Oh no, I No, I can't write a book on that. He says, yeah. I said, no. I said, Mr. Meredith has taught the class for 20 years on, you know, the first year Bible, the Gospels. I said, he ought to write it, not me. And then I come down a couple weeks, give another Bible study. He's like, you've got to write a book. You've got to write a book. I'm like, no. So then one day I'm in there gassing up my car at transportation. Many of you remember transportation, so I'm in there gassing up. And guess who comes in to gas up his car? Carl Kellner. And I have to add one thing here, too. After we came down to Pasadena, we took a vacation. This was in the first year when Carl first got up there. And I asked Alcaroz if I could go up there and keep Pentecost, and he said yes. Later, he denied it and said no. So he accused me of being rebellious. But when I got up to Salt Lake City, and they had combined services in Ogden, where Pocatello came down and combined with Salt Lake City. Boy, when I was there, all the brethren came to me, told me what a terrible thing that was happening with Carl Kellner, and how he just, you know, rode roughshod on them, come in and presume things, just to show you what happened. I ran both areas, Boise and Salt Lake. When I left, they gave him just Salt Lake, okay? And they gave Terry Swigerty Boise. I ran that whole thing on $395 expenses a month. Within 4 months after I was there, Carl Kellner had it up to $895 just in Salt Lake City. And that shows you the presumptuousness that he had toward everything. Well, anyway, I'm there with the brethren, visiting with the brethren, and lo and behold, they have a stage where we're meeting, and Carl Kellner has the table set up where he has the local elders up there, and he has the main deacons up there, and he says, Fred, come on up here and eat. He asked me 3 times to do it. I refused to do it. I stayed down there and talked with the brethren. I said, you know, okay, I'll be up later. That became a great sin. So anyway, here I am down at transportation, gassing up my car, and here comes in Carl Kellner. I said, oh, Carl, you know, what are you doing here? He says, oh, haven't you heard of the meeting? And I said, what meeting? And he just let it go at that. So I beat a path home, I told Dolores, and lo and behold, the phone rings. Okay, now this is on a Friday. Okay. And it's Al Caruso, and he says, we have a meeting up here and I want you to come up. I said, I'm not coming up unless Dolores comes with me. So we both went up there and we got ranted and raved at and berated for everything under the sun. And especially about that Brent Nolan thing. And especially about that paper that I wrote. And they just excoriated us, and, you know, we left just shaking, trembling, and in fear. And then the next Friday, he called me up to his office again. And he said, Fred Kolder, you're living your life dangerously, and your ministry is in danger, and, you know, you're in deep trouble. Ooh. So I walked home. We lived down in South Pasadena, and I got home, and I was just ghost white. Ash and gray and ghost white, if you could be the same time. So I walk in the house and Dolores says, what's the matter? So I told her. So I immediately began to fast and pray and called all my friends and said, fast and pray, you know, because I could see it was a terrible thing. They were coming to on pretense to get me out of the ministry. See? Okay. So Al Caruso said, he said, after all those things, he said, I can't discuss it with you now because I have to play racquetball. So that's when I walked home. Okay. I will call you Sunday. Because this was on Friday. Okay. So we fast and pray Sabbath. Oh, God, what is it? What's going on? You know. He didn't call Sunday. He didn't call Sunday night. Didn't call Monday morning. And I'm in the office, little office out at home, praying, oh, God, help me understand. Help me understand. What have I done? If I've done anything wrong, help me to know so I can repent and change. Please let me know what this is. And just like a voice came to me, Brett Nolan. And I said, that's it! Because I reinstated a man who should never have been disfellowshipped. So I came in and told Dolores. And so he didn't call all day Monday. Well, we quit fasting after we got the answer. Okay. He didn't call Tuesday morning. Late Tuesday afternoon he called and he said, Fred, I want you and Dolores to meet me down at the Carriage Inn. That's on California and Fair Oaks. So we get in there, and of course we're all nervous. You know, that kind of intimidation is to put you in fear and intimidation. So then he drove the nail home when we sat down to eat. And he said, Fred Coulter, I want to tell you one thing. He says, Dr. Zimmerman told me this one time, and I'm telling you the same thing, that what I have to say to you may not be right, but you better not open your mouth in one word. So I said to myself, I ain't saying nothing. So he ranted and raved about all these things, but there was nothing that they could do to get me out of the ministry. So guess what happened? Now, I'm sure not because of this, but because of many other things leading up to it. This was on Tuesday. Two days later on Thursday, Al Carozzo resigned and went with Ernest Martin. Friday, Rod Meredith was fired. So there's an example of how God will deliver you. See. That Sabbath, I saw Dave Brady, and I said, I'm writing the book. That was my sanity project when everything was going wrong in Pasadena. Remember this, whenever anything goes wrong, get your mind on Christ. Okay? They tried 4 times to kill the book. And Dave Brady was so excited about it that he got me on KABC Religion on the Line. Now that was from 9 to 12, call-in show. Yeah, but you have a Catholic priest, Protestant minister who I was for 4 weeks in a row, and a Jewish rabbi. And so over a course, it didn't take long. Everybody was calling and asking me questions because I brought my Bible and sat down and opened it. See? And Ted Armstrong was just nervous. He had the radio department monitor that and tape that if Fred Coulter said one word out of line, he was going to be summarily fired. And I didn't know that till later. See. So here I am on KABC Religion on the Line. That presumptuous Fred Coulter. How dare he go on radio without permission? See. You know, that's the way the hierarchy views it, see. Okay, it's like dealing with the hierarchy of the civil government, you know, So anyway, it turned out great. It was marvelous. It was quite an experience. And I remember someone called up about the 3 days and 3 nights, and I'd just done that for the Harmony, so I was able to just poo right out 3 days and 3 nights. And a Jewish woman called up, and she talked to the rabbi, and it was Rabbi Franklin. I always kid Carl about that because his name is Franklin. And she says, Rabbi Franklin, my 19-year-old grandson was killed in a car wreck, and he was studying to be a doctor, and he was the finest boy. Why did God allow it? take away my grandson. So he got done and says, now we all have to suffer, you know, the typical Jewish thing, see. So I said, well, would you mind if I answered something else for him? He said, no. I said, now, even in your scriptures, in Ezekiel 37, I want to tell you that God says that your grandson is going to be resurrected, that you will see him, you will hold him, you will love him, you will kiss him, and God will restore him to you and undo the evil of that tragedy. And she says, Rabbi Franklin, is that right? Hey, what can you do? It's in Ezekiel. Hey. So anyway, how much time do we have? What time is it? I don't even know. So, when I was transferred up to, after I finished in Pasadena, I'll just jump ahead. And after the harmony was done and I was up in Monterey, I thought, well, I have an idea for a radio program. So I walked into a radio station there in Monterey and said, I've got an idea for a radio program. Call-in program titled Bible Answers to Your Questions. So I showed the man the harmony and so forth, and he says, can you start Sunday? This was like on Thursday. And I thought, oh, man. So what I did, I cleared it with Norman Smith, who was the regional director, and he says, sure, go ahead. So I had a talk radio program for 2.5 years up in Monterey that I did every Sunday, every Sunday night. So anyway, back to Pasadena and back to the inner wars of the hierarchy. Well, let's see, that was after Ted Armstrong had been put out and reinstated for his philandering and so forth. So that was all going on. And, you know, Herbert Armstrong, I remember when he reinstated Ted, that the whole thing was just a big sham. And that with what Ted had done, that, you know, if anybody disqualified himself from the ministry, surely he had, you know. And of course, there was the standard for the peons, and the more equal standard for the mucky bucks. And of course, they didn't have to suffer from things. But just another little aside: when we first came down from Salt Lake to Pasadena, Bill Evans was in charge of the furnishings for the ministers, and they had certain houses that they were renting out and so forth from the highway department, where they had a planned freeway. They already had condemned and bought up the houses, but then it was stopped by a lawsuit, so they would rent them out. So we moved into 1949 South Pasadena Avenue in Pasadena. And he was in charge of the furnishings and furniture, and so he was giving me a tour of some of the evangelist homes. So he brought me into Al Portoon's home, which they were refurnishing. And he says, see these drapes? Yeah. $40,000. Out of third tithe. I didn't say a word, but I made up my mind right there. Because they gave all the local pastors, ministers, they gave them a checkbook to help the needy. Well, I was in Torrance, we had the whole Watts area, so we had plenty of needy. So I made up my mind, every dollar I write, they cannot spend. So I was very generous in helping those that had need. And after I decided to do the book, I spent the time, and it took me year and a half to do it, a paraphrased translation of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which was in the first and second edition. And during that time, there were four attempts to kill the book. And the first one was by Gunnar Freiberg's, and he couldn't find any good reason why I couldn't do it. The second one was by Lester Grabe, and he had me up in his office, and we were about 9 months away, and I just finished the paraphrase translation at that time. And he says, well, who do you think you are, Fred Coulter, writing this book? You're not a scholar. And I said, well, you know what Mr. Armstrong thinks about scholars, don't you? I said, I tell you what, I'll make you a deal. I said, it's going to be published in about 9 months, and I will give you the whole paraphrase translation I have. So I did. Paid $120 to copy all the pages and give it to him. Never heard back from him, but I gave it to him. And I said, if there's anything in there that's doctrinally incorrect, let me know, and I'll be happy to change it. So then the third time they tried to kill it. The fourth time was really not trying to kill it, but it was an acquiescence to it. After Rod Meredith was fired, David Antion was put in as superintendent of the ministry. And his assistant was Les Stocker. Now, Les was really a fine, fine man. I really liked him. But Ted Armstrong told David Antion to kill the book that Fred Coulter was doing. So Les got the job. So he took me out to dinner at the Peppermill. Since he lived one place, I lived another, we met at the parking lot in the Hall of Administration. So we went out to dinner, had our niceties and our chat and everything, and came back, and we're standing there in the parking lot, and he says, Ted Armstrong doesn't want you to do the book. And I said, I have a message for Ted Armstrong. I am not sinning against God. I am not violating any contract because I have signed no contract with the church. It is going to be doctrinally correct, and by this time I'm shouting, okay? Because of all the things I went through, and I said, and I have a message for Ted Armstrong. I said, you tell him that it's going to be published, and when it is, if I am disfellowshipped, that he's going to have a hard time explaining to the brethren why I was disfellowshipped for writing a book that is true. Turned around and walked away. And I was very sorry that that happened because Les was really a nice man. Only problem is he was doing his political duty. Well, just before it was published, and I borrowed $22,000 on my own to do it. Okay? We had a small ministerial conference, and David Antion was there. And in a break, I was out leaning up, against the door. Of course, only one or two ministers would talk to me because I was non person non grata, you know, in the hierarchy of the political accepted. And he sidled up to me and he says, "Fred," he says, "you going to publish the book?" I says, "You bet." He says, "When is it coming out?" I said, "It's going to be about 2 months." And he says, "We have one request." I said, "What's that?" "Do not mention Worldwide Church of God or Ambassador College." And I said, "You got a deal." So that's why in the dust jacket there's nothing about the church or Ambassador College. Okay. So published the book. Had 10,000 published. Very interesting. Now, we had a small house. Now, 10,000 books on pallets delivered by a freight truck, a long one, requires a lot of room. So I was down talking to John Egbert, who was in charge of the press at that time, and I was telling him about it. And he says, "Fred, come here." Because I used to work in supplies, you know, where they have the steel stanchions, where they have the shelves, and you can put pallets on there. He says, "I'll tell you what." He says, "See that row on top up there?" I said, "Yeah." "It's empty, isn't it?" He says, "You have the truck when they deliver come here at 4:45, and I will get the forklift man, and we will put them up there." So sure enough, right under their nose, there they sat. Okay. And when they came in, I opened up one pallet and took down some boxes of books, and I gave autographed them and gave them to everybody in the press. And they were all happy with them, thrilled to death with them. And then I didn't want to charge the brethren a lot for it. It cost me something like $2. It took the whole $22,000 to do it, so just say $2.22 a book. It was done by R.R. Donnelly in Crawfordsville, Indiana, where they make encyclopedias and everything. And by the way, during that time, I also helped Bill Dankenbrink start his Triumph Publishing. And he asked me how to do it, who to contact, and that's how he got the book on the 10 Laws of Radiant Health. Okay. So, anyway, then at a Bible study one night, someone said, well, why don't we use Fred Coulter's Harmony in First Year Bible? You know, you send up the question, he read it out, and said, well, Fred Coulter's not a scholar. And boy, he stirred up a hornet's nest with that. Boy, did he ever. So anyway, to make a long story short, there was a battle back and forth, and finally they acquiesced to sell it in the college bookstore. Okay? Well, why couldn't you sell it? Well, you sell other books by other people. You don't approve what they, you know. Okay. Finally got it in. And then, I think it was before I got it into the bookstore, I decided to give an autographed copy to Ted Armstrong. So he had an assembly with the students there, and I knew he was in there, and I knew he would come across from the auditorium over to the Hall of Administration, so I was waiting on the steps. When I saw that he was coming out the door, I went back on the inside door of the Hall of Administration, and I just waited for him. I had a book in hand already autographed. Okay? So when he came in, I said, hi, Mr. Armstrong. Reached out and shook his hand. And I said, here's an autographed copy of my book. And he said, thank you, very nervously, and went on his way. Well, needless to say, who was the next one to write a book? Ted Armstrong, the book called what? The Real Jesus, written by Robert Kuhn. I mean, Ted Armstrong. Okay? So then, Helen Stiles, who was Mr. Armstrong's secretary at the time, she got a book. She called me and said, you need to come and give a book to Mr. Armstrong. Well, I'd already talked to him several times over, and he knew me and so forth. And so she said, bring an autographed copy. So what I did, I went to a photographer and I had the etchings enlarged and on white photographic paper and had them framed with the thin black frames with a nice glass front on them and so forth. And I took those up with me. And so the time for the appointment came. Mrs. Stiles let me in. There was Herbert Armstrong, very friendly, very friendly. We sat and talked, reminisced a little bit about old times, and I showed him the book, autographed it, gave it to him, and he said, oh, this is wonderful. This is nice. And then talked a little bit about that, and then I brought up one of the pictures that I had, and I said, Mr. Armstrong, here's a personal gift for you. And these were the etchings of the temple. And he came unglued with excitement. He was so happy to get those. And he said, picked up the phone, and he said, Mrs. Stiles, get in here right away. Bang! So she comes in and says, I want you to call Bob Smith, the interior decorator, and I want these hung in the auditorium. So there are the four etchings that very day were hung in the auditorium down in the little alcove between the two classrooms on the lower floor. And I bet they're still there to this day. Okay? And I felt very much like Mordecai. And when I left, I gave Mr. Armstrong a handshake, He gave me a big hug, and I hugged him, shook my hand again, and he said, "You know, I wish more ministers would write books." Thank you, God. Okay. So then, we had a ministerial conference, and this was in 1974. And there was a lot of trouble in the church at that time. And the black ministers were all up in arms. And at that conference, they promised the black ministers that they would have a conference on black issues. One of the sessions would be on that. And in my congregation in Torrance, we had 40% were black and 30% were black up in Santa Monica. 30% were Hispanic and 40% were white. And we had no race problems where I was, because I don't think in racial terms. I think in terms of helping people who are in need, teach them what they need to know, give them advice that they need, because they're human beings like anybody else and everybody needs help. They failed to put it on the agenda. And that was because David Antion was relieved of being superintendent of ministers and Wayne Cole was put in. So they hastily set one up, extended the ministerial conference a day. And boy, I tell you, when we walked in there, it was like walking into an NAACP meeting with George Bush doing the talking. Hostility, you couldn't believe it. And I sat there, oh God, this is bad. I didn't know that they had all these feelings and hatred and just, I mean, it was spewing over like I had never heard before. So I said, oh God, deliver me out of this. How can I be delivered out of this mess? So it came to me while I was sitting there listening, and I came up to Wayne Cole afterwards, and I didn't let him know a thing, but I just said, you know, Mr. Cole, I've been here now 4 years. And I said, it'd be nice to kind of share the smog with someone else, and if it would be possible, I would really like to come in for a sabbatical. And it wouldn't cost you anything because I live here right now. You wouldn't have to move me or anything. So he says, I'll call you in a couple of days. So he called and said, yes, you can go on a sabbatical. So went on a sabbatical, and David Antion was teaching the classes, and Dr. Martin was teaching classes, and Art McCurrow was teaching classes. And that's when I had Dr. Dorothy start a Greek class, and I paid for it, guaranteed it. We started out with 10. In 8 weeks, we were down to 3, and in 10 weeks, it was down just to me. So I ended up virtually with private tutoring with Greek, so I had the time to really learn it, to really understand it. So I got the equivalent of 2 years college Greek within the 1 year. Well, all during the time, they said, well, you older pastors, you can choose where you want to go in the church areas, whichever ones are open. And so we get into the second semester, and I knew that San Jose was coming open because I knew that they were going to bring in Wayne Dunlap. So I was the senior pastor among all those that were there. And at that time, Dennis Pyle was one of the assistants in church administration, and he was responsible for placing us. Well, they slated me to go to Minnesota. Well, David has these bronchial problems at that time, catch pneumonia real quickly, so we can't go there. So they wanted to send me to Texas. And I said, I would have a hard time being accepted in Texas. Well, how about Wheeling, West Virginia? And I thought to myself, you really want to bury me, don't you? So I looked Dennis Pyle right in the eye and I said, you guys are a bunch of hypocrites, political hypocrites. You tell us one thing, and I know that San Jose is open, and you tell me that I have to go here and there. And I said, yeah, and you want to bury me, don't you, in Wheeling, West Virginia? I said, now I'm going to hold you to your word. Either I get San Jose, or I'm not transferring. I'm going to hold you to your word. Well, he didn't like that. He wasn't these smooth, young, political, get-along, go-along political climbers. Plus, inbred into the family system, you know, the Hammers. Piles and Hammers and so forth. So anyway, I guess that kind of took them back. So what they did, they got a hold of Rick Guype in Monterey. And they said, Rick, we have a promotion for you. We have two churches down here in Southern California that we would like you to pastor. And Monterey was 140 people. So going from almost 800 to 140. So they came and they said, Fred, we can't give you San Jose, but how's Monterey? And I figured, thank you, God. Yes, I will take it. So that's how we got to Monterey. And so we moved up there. That's how we got to Hollister. Well, we sold our house and had $10,000 down to put on another house when we moved up to Monterey. It was actually Hollister, and I would drive over, and we moved out on some acreage. You know, if you're in the city, you like to get in the country. So we bought 2.5 acres. We got a house that had two bedrooms. I put an addition on it when we were there, and in 2.5 years, we sold it for 92. We bought it for 47, sold it for 92, and built a house in town. Well, right about the time we were ready to build the house in town, the word came down, don't visit the brethren unless they ask you. Hey, I could visit all the heads of house twice a month, hands down, with no problem. Now you're telling me don't visit until they ask. So that's when we built our house. And I did 50% hands-on. I'd get up and I'd be up there at 7 in the morning, work on the house, go visit from 2 until about 8 at night, and so forth. So anyway, if you hear that Fred Coulter lives in a mansion, according to some people's description, we do. It's 4,200 square feet. We bought it ourselves. It's our own money. Didn't use any church money. It cost us $78,000 to build, including the land. We got a 16,000 square foot lot for $13,000. We've kept it up and improved it through the years. Today it's worth probably $800,000. But why even sell it? Because it would cost you that much to replace what you have, or even more. The overseas offices are Canada, Post Office Box 125, Brockville, Ontario, Postal Code K6V5V2. For Australia, Biblical Truth Ministries, GPO Box 1574, Sydney 2001. New Zealand, Post Office Box 242, Waihi, Waihi 2981. Republic of South Africa, Post Office Box 2624, Wilro, Park, Postal Code 1731. United Kingdom, Post Office Box 8224, Witham,
postal code CM81WZ, United Kingdom.